from deep inside your radio.
Oh, to be in New Orleans this weekend, time of the Final Four, to walk around and be surrounded by all the corporate enjoyment that sits like pyramid-like, built right on top of athletes playing for free. What a wonderful time. You're probably aware, ladies and gentlemen, that Keith Olbermann, who has had a storied career in television, in every sense of the word, storied, has severed relations with his most recent employer, although he had stake in the company, so I guess he was his own employer. He severed relations with himself. The employer in question was Current TV, television channel founded by and run by Al Gore and a partner. And I've had my eye on Current TV since they took over. They didn't start from scratch. You see, that would be too scratchy. Instead, they bought what they described then as very obscure television channel. I happened to watch it. That's how obscure it was. Called News World International. It was the international version of a Canadian news channel, and it had international news 24 hours a day. How peculiar is that? So they squelched that, turned that off, and started this thing called Current TV, which has always had fewer viewers than News World International. Anyway, as I say, they had hired Keith Olbermann when he left MSNBC last year. And he was supposed to resume doing his broadcast countdown for them. And that all came to an end this week. And he will make an appearance in the Apologies of the Week. But, you know, he does traffic in news. And so the most interesting part of the email traffic that became public between the Olbermann side and the Current TV side over the weekend was a note from Keith's manager deep into the year that he was there and complaining about, you know, the lights going out and little things that would interfere with a television program. And the manager said, Keith is beginning to get the impression that this is a rinky-dink operation. Had you never seen Current TV before? Just a question. Ladies and gentlemen, for nearly 6 years, mysterious condition called colony collapse disorder, no, not in Malibu, has been wreaking havoc with the honeybee population in the United States and Europe. The cause of CCD remains elusive, various fingers being pointed at mites, fungi, viruses, pesticides, and Geraldo Rivera. Today, now that is to say this week, a pair of studies published in Science suggest that sublethal exposure to a family of common pesticides might play a contributing role in the bee die-off. Neonicotinoids. Those sound good. Marlboro Man likes them. Are a relatively new family of insecticides. I guess the nicotine business decided to switch focus. They work by switching receptors for a neurotransmitter to the on state, causing paralysis and death in insects. They work on a similar manner to nerve gases like sarin. Neonicotinoids are less toxic to mammals than insects and rapidly gain favor for use in agriculture, where they're widely used to treat seeds. The insecticide diffuses throughout the plant as it grows, appearing in the pollen and nectar, which foraging honeybees collect and bring back to their hives. A study from a team of French researchers looked at the effect on honeybees of sublethal exposure to one of these, the one called thiamethoxam. I just want to be the guy who gets paid to name these. Second study was conducted by a group from the UK looking at the effect of imidacloprid, the most widely used neonicotinoid, on bumblebees. In the U.S., commercial beekeepers and environmental groups have petitioned the EPA to ban another neonicotinoid, clothianidin. France, Germany, and Slovenia have already banned or limited the use of all of these pesticides. The EPA considered taking action in 2010, but declined to do so at the time, leading to accusations that the agency approved clothianidin based in part on a fraudulent study conducted by its manufacturer, Bayer. But, you know, we could pollinate the crops. Easy. Don't need bees. Hello, welcome to the show. Just stick your butt in the flower and let nature do the rest. Speaking of rinky-dink operations, from the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, I'm Harry Shearer. Welcome you to this edition of the show. And now, the rinky-dinkitude continues as I read the trades for you. From Media Daily News, Coke loses faith. Yes, I'll read it for you. Who else? Mike Daisy? Coca-Cola looks to focus its TV ad spending on so-called DVR-proof events while buttressing them, with 360-degree campaigns. With ad skipping rampant, the company has lost faith in the effectiveness of traditional ads in comedies and dramas, save for the Super Bowl, which is not a traditional comedy. I interpolate that for you. American Idol and other programming that consumers watch live and talk about the next day around the Coke machine. The 30-second spots on television are no longer the way to do it, says Gary Fayard, chief financial officer of Coke. You still do 30-second spots, but if you're like me, most of the television you watch, you record, and when you then watch it, you skip over all the ads. But you will watch certain shows live because you want to be able to talk about them tomorrow when you go to work. Are you like him? Still, even as advertising is concentrated in live-oriented events and sports, Coke is planning a major Olympic initiative this summer. A traditional spot can no longer stand alone. Links and integrated campaigns will use social and digital media and opportunities for consumers to take some ownership of brands and pass along endorsements. That's crucial, says Fayard. A like is not good enough. You want a share. Because consumers today believe they own our brands. They are the ones that talk to each other about which brands live up to their promise and which ones don't. So having that integrated campaign across all the different platforms is critically important. Coke will also sponsor the European Championship Soccer Tournament this summer. Fayard projects that 1 billion more people will enter the middle class globally over the next 8 years, with a similar number moving to cities from rural areas, and that should provide a boon for the non-alcoholic beverage industry. Coke also plans probably to do more things like painting illegal stencil advertisements over the historic sidewalks of the French Quarter, which they did this week in New Orleans. That's integrated. But that's just me talking, not Media Daily News. Here's a little message for Coke. Go deface Atlanta. And also from Media Daily News, box office revenues from 3D movies dropped 18% last year. Those high-tech movie share of the overall market also slipped to 18% from 21% the year previous. Many TV companies have invested in 3D programs, networks, and services, which have also been slow growing. How about current TV 3D? Keith? That occurs to me when I read the trades for you. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now, ladies and gentlemen, some of the body scanners that peer through passengers' clothing at U.S. airports often go unused, wasting millions of dollars, a government report has found. Well, who'd have thunk it? Scanners at a portion of the airports were used as little as 5% of the days after they were installed by the TSA, according to Steve Lord, Director of Homeland Security and Justice Issues at the Government Accountability Office. The limited use of some of those machines may indicate that there was not a clear need for them at the time they were acquired at the locations in which they were deployed, he said in testimony to a joint congressional committee. A TSA spokesman acknowledged in email that the initial placement of the scanners was, quote, not optimal. The agency is taking steps to use them more efficiently, said the official. J. Kawika Riley. Lord's testimony didn't say how many scanners aren't being used or identify the airports. Some scanners are used less than 30% of the time. At one of the 12 airports the GAO investigators visited, the TSA deployed 3 scanners in a terminal that typically handled 1 flight a day with about 230 passengers. Maybe they've heard us. Lord also questioned the effectiveness of a TSA program intended to detect suspicious behavior. Quote, questions related to the program's validity will remain until the agency demonstrates conclusively it can identify terrorists and improve security. The TSA has arrested 2,273 people after TSA officers questioned people under this program. But TSA officials told the GAO they weren't aware of any terrorist or person planning to engage in terrorist-related activities who'd been arrested under the program. So just 2,273 arrests for other things by TSA. Turn off the scanners. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the atom.
Clean, safe, too cheap to meet.
Our friend.
Safe, cheap, too cheap to meet. Cheap, safe, too safe to meet. Safe, safe, too safe to meet.
We'll start with this, Addy. The atom, are you sitting down?
How can I sit down? I'm spinning.
All right. Well, spin sitting. Nuclear power is no longer an economically viable source of new energy in the United States. That's not me saying that. That's not Union of Concerned Scientists saying that. That's not Russ Feingold saying that. It's not even Dennis Kucinich saying that. It's the newly retired CEO of America's largest producer of nuclear power.
Exelon.
He said this in Chicago this week. And it won't become economically viable, he says, for the foreseeable future. Quote, let me state unequivocally that I've never met a nuclear plant I didn't like, says John Rowe, retired as chairman and CEO of Exelon, which operates 22 nuclear power plants, more than anybody else in the United States. Having said that, let me also state unequivocally that new ones don't make any sense right now, unquote. Speaking at the University of Chicago's Harris School of Public Policy, said, Rowe said, I'm the nuclear guy.
Oh, he's the one. Give me his number.
No, no, no. And you won't get better results with nuclear. It just isn't economic, and it's not economic within a foreseeable time frame, he says. He didn't touch upon the politics, political vulnerability of nuclear power since the Fukushima accident. The argument was economic, and he added, paints a picture that
Exelon
itself does not favor. Former Commonwealth Edison CEO Tom Ayers built the reactor fleet now owned by
Exelon
because, Rowe said, he thought they were best for the environment. But Ayers, by the time the reactors broke even on their initial cost, Ayers was suffering from Alzheimer's disease. He died in 2007. Says Rowe, I'm not fond of investments that don't pay off before I'm incapable of comprehending it.
He's just bitter.
Right. The plutonium Japan has stockpiled for decades was supposed to be a smart energy source for the resource-poor nation, but last year's earthquake-triggered nuclear accident, along with growing global anxiety about extremists gaining access to radioactive material, is turning this potential asset into a liability, according to the Washington Post. Uncertainty and fear in the Fukushima prefecture, of course, continues. And speaking at the Nuclear Security Summit in Seoul, Korea this week, Japanese Prime Minister Noda described a, quote, myth of safety, unquote, that he said had lulled Japan into a false sense of security about its nuclear facilities. Back to the plutonium. President Obama noted that the smallest amount of plutonium, about the size of an apple, could kill hundreds and thousands and spark a global crisis. We simply can't go on accumulating huge amounts of the very material, like separated plutonium, that we're trying to keep away from terrorists, he told a university audience in Seoul, Korea. Because opposition to nuclear energy has spiraled in Japan since Fukushima, the country is operating just one of its 54 reactors and has scant hope of activating more anytime soon. That means there is little use for the company's stockpiles of separated plutonium, and there are few easy options for reducing the supply.
Throw it in the trash.
Really?
Yeah, I would.
Yeah, but you spin. Only one of Japan's, as I said, 54 commercial reactors remains in service. And that one suspended operation of its last running nuclear reactor early this week amid lingering safety concerns. The halt of the number 6 reactor at TEPCO's Kashiwazaki Kariwa complex in Niigata Prefecture adds to concerns about stable power supply this summer when demands will peak with heavy use of air conditioning on hot days. Nuclear plants had provided nearly one-third of Japan's electric power supply to the prior to the Fuk disaster. The sole operating nuclear reactor in the number 3 unit of the Tomari plant in Hokkaido will be suspended May 5 for routine checkup. Since Fuk, no reactors have resumed operations after undergoing new checks. Kelpoff, Southern California, was contaminated with short-lived radioisotopes a month after Japan's Fuk accident, a sign that the spilled radiation reached California's coastline, according to a new scientific study. So thank you over there. We hear you. We read you. We're clicking. Our dosimeters are working. We see you. Thank you very much. Scientists from Cal State Long Beach, hey, tested giant kelp from the ocean off Orange County and other locations after the March accident and detected radioactive iodine, which was released from the damaged reactor. The largest concentration was 250-fold higher than levels reported in West Coast kelp before the accident. Of course, isn't kelp a good... No, I see. It's a good source of non-radioactive iodine normally. Of course, we all knew that. But back to the story. Basically, we saw it in all the California kelp blades we sampled, says Stephen Manley, a biology professor at Cal State Long Beach. The radioactivity had no known effects on the giant kelp or on fish and other marine life or marines. And it was undetectable when the kelp was tested again a month later because radioactive iodine has such a short shelf life. Half-life. Sorry. The U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, citing serious concerns about equipment failures at the San Onofre nuclear power plant just south of Los Angeles, has prohibited Southern California Edison from restarting the plant until the problems are thoroughly understood, you see, and fixed. The plant has been shut down for 2 months, the longest in San Onofre's history, after a tube leak.
I hate those.
And one of the plant's steam generators released a small amount of radioactive steam. Since then, unusual wear has been found on hundreds of tubes that carry radioactive water. Don't panic. It's fine. Neither regulators nor Edison have said when they believe the plant will reopen. That is Southern California's only nuclear power plant.
I love it.
State officials are already working on contingency plans to avoid power outages during the summer. They're considering transmission upgrades. Those would be good. Bringing back retired generating units at a natural gas plant in Huntington Beach and launching new conservation efforts, including flex alerts to encourage customers to use less energy. They haven't been doing that before because we had a leaking nuclear plant. Until now, the cause of the two problems had been a mystery, but in a letter to federal regulators sent to Edison, officials said tubes were vibrating and rubbing against support structures and adjacent tubes. Zillions of dollars in technology screwed by vibrations and rubbing. You see what I'm saying, ladies and gentlemen? One of Japan's crippled nuclear... What are you looking at me like that, Hattie?
Just looking.
One of Japan's crippled nuclear reactors still has fatally high radiation levels and hardly any water to cool it, according to an internal examination this week that renews doubts about the plant's stability. A tool equipped with a tiny video camera, a thermometer, a dosimeter, and a water gauge was used to assess damage inside the number 2 reactor's containment chamber for the second time since the disaster. The probe, done in January, failed to find the water surface and provided images only showing steam, unidentified parts, and rusty metal surfaces scarred by exposure to radiation, heat, and humidity. The data collected from the probe showed the damage from the disaster was so severe, the plant operator will have to develop special equipment and technology to tolerate the harsh environment in order to decommission the plant, a process expected to last decades. Tuesday's examination with an industrial endoscope detected radiation levels up to 10 times the fatal dose inside the chamber. Plant officials previously said more than half of melted fuel has breached the core, dropping to the floor of the primary containment vessel, some of it splashing against the wall or the floor. Particles from melted fuel have probably sent radiation levels up to dangerously high levels inside the container. It's extremely high, said a spokesman for TEPCO, saying the endoscope itself would last only 14 hours in that condition. We have to develop equipment that can tolerate high radiation when locating and removing melted fuel during the decommissioning. Yeah, that's a good idea. Why didn't I think of that?
Why didn't I?
Good question. Clean, cheap, safe, too swell to meet her. Our friend the atom. Addy?
I'm spinning out.
And back to oil and back to the in the Gulf of Mexico. Wetland areas in North Barataria Bay and the Pasalutra Wildlife Management Area at the mouth of the Mississippi River continue to show signs of oil that Louisiana officials say is from the BP oil spill. A set of photos posted this week on Flickr show oil sheen, not the brother you're thinking of, and oil drops in and around reeds in middle ground, an area just inside a wildlife refuge. A second set taken in northern Barataria Bay include photos of matted oil pulled from wetland soil that state officials said had been declared clean by Coast Guard and BP officials. These are places where we absolutely need long-term monitoring, says Olivia Watkins, an authority spokeswoman, in an email describing the photos. The state has been critical of a decision by the Coast Guard and BP late last year to not require long-term monitoring for areas where cleanup operations were declared complete. You're not seeing these in those TV ads about the Gulf, are you? Watkins said warm weather is now causing oil to bubble up in those cleaned areas. But the Gulf is open for business. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the warm, won't you?
Soft, listen to the warm. We can listen to the warm.
Copyrighted, award-winning copyrighted feature of this broadcast. There may be another route to avoid the potentially disastrous effects of climate change. We can deliberately alter ourselves, three researchers suggest. Human engineering, as they call it, poses less danger than altering our planet through geoengineering, and it could augment changes to personal behavior or policies to mitigate climate change, they write in an article published in the journal Ethics, Policy, and the Environment. I hate that journal. Too many ads. We are serious philosophers, but we might not be entirely serious that people should be doing this, says Anders Sandberg, one of the authors and an ethicist at Oxford. What we are arguing is we should be taking a look at this at the very least. In their article, they put forward a series of suggestions. Induce intolerance to red meat genetically, since livestock farming accounts for a significant portion of greenhouse gas emissions. Make humans smaller to reduce the amount of energy we each need to consume. Reduce birth rates by making people smarter, since higher cognitive ability appears linked to lower birth rates. Why don't we just make people smarter to start with? Full stop. And treat people with hormones such as oxytocin to make us more altruistic and empathic. As a result, people would be more willing to act as a group and more sensitive to the suffering of animals and other people caused by climate change. Geoengineering solutions, these scientists say, are problematic because they cannot be tested before being implemented, and once implemented, the effects would be global. If I want to test out one of these brain-enhancing devices, I can test it on medical students. If something goes wrong, I might get a lawsuit, but it is a localized problem. How do you test geoengineering, Sandberg says? How many Earths do we have to test on? And the disappearance of Arctic sea ice has crossed a tipping point that could soon make ice-free summers a regular feature across most of the Arctic Ocean by oil stock. Says a British climate scientist who is setting up an early warning system for dangerous climate tipping points. Tim Lenton at Exeter University has carried out a day-by-day assessment of Arctic ice cover data collected since satellite observation began in 1979. He presented his findings this week in London. Up till 2007, sea ice systematically fluctuated between extensive cover in winter and lower cover in summer. But since then, says Lenton, the difference between winter and summer ice cover has been 1 million square kilometers greater than before 2007. as a result of unprecedented summer melting. These observations are in contrast to what models predict should have happened. Why are you asking models? They just look nice. Despite fears of runaway sea ice loss after summer cover hit an all-time low in 2007, modeling studies based on our best understanding of ice dynamics indicated the ice cover should fully recover each winter. Instead, Lenton's research shows a permanent alteration. According to data from the past 5 years, the Arctic sea ice has not recovered from the extreme low of 2007. The system, he says, has passed a tipping point. What caused the change is still unclear. He speculates that the exceptional low in 2007 might have allowed the ocean to absorb so much heat that a lot of the thicker multi-year ice, which tend to persist through the summer, was melted. Alternatively, the loss of ice may have changed air circulation patterns above the Arctic in ways that have similarly locked in the change. As I say, now the Arctic will be ice-free. We can drill there, drill now, and only hurt puffins. They eat puffins, don't they?
It's a funny old game, this thing we call love. No one explains, it has two faces. I wish you the best, I wish you the worst, pity and shame, forgiveness and blame, a kiss and then a curse. The bitterest of words, the gentlest of touch, or they live side by side, and sometimes that is almost enough. Happy today, tomorrow who knows, I'll threaten to leave, and you'll beg me to go. We twist and we turn, we struggle with fate. Oh, the more that we love, darling, the deeper that we can hate. It's a funny old game, this thing we call love. No one explains, it has two faces. Like the sun and the rain, love has two faces.
This is Le Show, and now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Farron Butler of Elma, Washington, says he's heartbroken over deleted phone messages that can never be replaced because the person who left those messages is dead. Butler said he was devastated when he discovered the saved voice messages from his daughter were gone. He's been replaying them since she lost her battle with cancer last June at age 14. Her messages on all her family phones were deleted after Butler agreed to a free trial for T-Mobile's voicemail-to-text service. The feature turns your voicemail into a text message. But they failed to mention it would delete my voice messages or I would never have done it, said Butler. T-Mobile deeply regrets the sorrow the Butler family is experiencing. When saving voice messages long-term, customers receive an alert and are prompted to resave messages they'd like to keep. Unfortunately, when the voicemail-to-text feature was added, which has a shorter window for saving messages, the voice messages were deleted. We sincerely apologize that the Butlers were not adequately made aware of this possibility and are working to make sure this information is communicated in the future. Why I still have an answering machine. The head of a Japanese investment company accused of losing more than $1 billion in clients' pension funds apologized this week, saying he intends to repay losses that were concealed for years. Yeah, just like the Americans do when that happens, right? AIJ. So close to AIG, and yet it's a J. Investment Advisors President Asakawa made the apology in a committee hearing at Japan's parliament. He said he ordered company financial reports to be falsified to conceal the losses. Oh, well, that's the best of reasons. New Zealand's third-ranked cabinet minister apologized this week for derogatory comments about Finland after a Finnish comedian responded with a vitriolic televised attack. If I've offended people, I'm sorry about that, Jerry Brownlee, transport minister and the center-right government's leader of the House of Representatives, told reporters. Brownlee said, all I can say is what I said was meant to be humorous, and I apologize for people not seeing the humor in it. What he had said, he was attacking a set of economic policies suggested by the opposition leader David Shearer, no relation, which he said aimed to make New Zealand, quote, like Finland, which has worse unemployment than us, that has less growth than us, and hardly feed the people who live there, has a terrible homicide rate, hardly educates their people, and has no respect for women, unquote. In fact, two of Finland's last five prime ministers have been women, while its education system is consistently ranked one of the world's best. But it was humorous. You get it, don't you? Say you do. Representatives of two Greek life organizations at the University of Denver publicly apologized this week for a Cowboys and Indians theme party last month that offended Native American students at a campus gathering both sides hoped would lead to greater understanding. Lambda Chi Alpha and Delta Delta Delta, the Tri-Delts. We love the Delts. Hosted the party February 25th. 3 days later, members of the Native Student Alliance saw photos of the party, including revelers in Indian garb, on Facebook and contacted the university's assistant provost for inclusive excellence. Enough said. Boston Red Sox pitcher John Lackey has apologized for using the word retarded to describe some of the news media coverage of the Red Sox. Quote, I apologize for my thoughtless choice of words that appeared in print, Lackey said. I meant no harm, and I am sorry to all I offended. When asked by a question by Boston Globe columnist concerning reports of Red Sox pitchers, including Lackey drinking beer and eating chicken in the clubhouse during games, as the Red Sox collapsed in September, Lackey had originally said, guys having a beer after their start has been going on for the last 100 years. This is retarded. He's sorry he said that. Now on, he will refer to it as special needs. The Canadian Forest Service apologized Wednesday for a... Sorry, the Colorado Forest Service apologized Wednesday for a wildfire attributed to a controlled burn that got out of control, killing at least two people, and the governor announced a suspension of such burns. This is heartbreaking and we're sorry, State Forester Joe Duda told reporters about the Lower North Fork fire, which has scorched thousands of acres. A team is being formed to investigate how last Thursday's controlled burn re-erupted on Monday as a wildfire. Well, we all believe in second chances in this country, don't we? Keith Olbermann's apology. Quote, I'd like to apologize to my viewers and my staff for the failure of current TV. Unquote. Victims' rights advocates are blasting the pastor of a Boston Catholic church for placing a blurb in a Sunday bulletin asking for donations to support a parish priest suspended over child abuse allegations. It is callous and risky and hurtful to publicly raise funds using church resources for an accused child molester, says the head of the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priest. Monsignor Frank Kelly, whom the Boston Archdiocese called an outstanding pastor, issued an apology saying, I wish to express my apology to all impacted by this action. I now recognize that this announcement was not an appropriate use of the parish bulletin. I offer my personal assurance that such announcements will not be permitted going forward. Doesn't he get a little clap? Mike Daisy addressed the issue of his show about Apple's work practices in China on his website. He's apologized for going against the rules he set for himself about staying true to the facts in his work. Now, I was going to read you some of this, but I'll just say, now that he's going to do that, work on the brevity, babe. Belvedere Vodka executives quickly apologized for an ad posted online that showed a smiling man grabbing a woman who appeared to be in fear from behind. Unlike some people, Belvedere always goes down smoothly, the ad's caption read. It drew hundreds of negative comments after it appeared on the company's Facebook page, with many suggesting it appeared to depict an assault. Belvedere Vodka Marketing Senior Vice President Jason Lundy posted an apology on the page, saying the ad also offended the people who work here at Belvedere. The post is absolutely inconsistent with our values and beliefs, and in addition to removing the offensive post, we're committed to making sure that something like this doesn't happen again, he said. Company President Charles Gibb added his apology the next day. It should never have happened. I'm currently investigating the matter. The company's apology included a donation to the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network as an expression of our regret. Amount of the donation, unpublic. British newspaper The Mail on Sunday has apologized to a French bank, Societe Generale, and agreed to pay damages after an article it published last August claimed France's second largest bank was on the brink of disaster, which it was not. We accept that this was untrue, the paper said. We've apologized to the bank and agreed to pay damages. A restaurant in Atlanta, Chops and Hops, has just unveiled the Black and Blue Burger. Blue, B-L-E-U, which was apparently inspired by the Chris Brown and Rihanna abusive relationship. An award-winning celebrity sandwich, says on its Facebook page. Chris Brown won't beat you up for eating this unless your name starts with an R and ends with an A. The new burger drew plenty of criticism, and the restaurant eventually took down its Facebook post. Boy, people are getting in trouble on Facebook. The burger has been removed from the menu. Chops and Hops has apologized for the domestic violence burger and assured its customers they do not support domestic violence. The restaurant also said proceeds from the burger would go to Project Safe, but it's off the menu, so there are no proceeds. So, Project Not Safe. BBC has apologized for calling the Holy Festival of Colors celebration in Spanish Fork, England, a filthy festival, because people threw multicolored chalk, was it? Powder, colored powder into the air. They're now describing it as a festival of colors. Susan G. Komen of Susan G. Komen for The Cure founder Nancy Brinker sent a letter this week to members of Congress apologizing for the organization's mistakes during the recent controversy over Planned Parenthood grants and asking representatives to support funding for an early, lobby. When Carson Daly apologized this week for implying that gay people wouldn't have been able to take down the JetBlue pilot who melted down on a recent flight. And finally, two apologies in connection with the Trayvon Martin story. Geraldo Rivera apologized for remarks he made about hoodies and how wearing one may have factored in the death of Trayvon Martin. He had said, "I think the hoodie is as much responsible for Trayvon Martin's death as George Zimmerman." Now, he says, "I apologize to anyone offended by what one prominent black conservative called my very practical and potentially life-saving campaign urging black and Hispanic parents not to let their children going around wearing hoodies. He said, "By putting responsibility on what kids wear instead of how people react to them, I have obscured the main point that someone shot and killed an unarmed teenager." He's now offering a sincere and heartfelt apology to anyone he may have offended in his crusade to warn minority families of the danger to their young sons inheriting gangster-style clothing like hoodies. That's an apology with a hook. And speaking of which, Spike Lee, ladies and gentlemen.
We're in the middle of the desert.
No, we're not, Spike. We're at the beach. Spike Lee has apologized to a Florida couple who say they were forced to leave their home when a Twitter posting the director helped spread listed their address as that of George Zimmerman. They're in their 70s and say they have a son named William George Zimmerman who lived in their home in the mid-90s. He's no relation. Lee tweeted, "I deeply apologize to the McLean family for retweeting their address. It was a mistake. Please leave the McLeans in peace." And he spells the McLeans with an apostrophe S.
We're in the middle of the desert.
No, we're not, Spike. But Thank you for pointing that out. The Apology of the Week, ladies and gentlemen, it's a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And as the Trayvon Martin controversy continues, question remains, who was heard crying for help on that 911 call? According to the Orlando Sentinel, a leading expert in the field of forensic voice identification, says it was not George Zimmerman calling for help, despite the claims by the families of Mr. Zimmerman and his lawyer that it was him, that it was he calling for help. Actually, two experts have examined the 911 tapes and have decided that it was not George Zimmerman calling for help. There's a lot of controversy about the whole case, of course, much of it centering around the Stand Your Ground law. Florida and more than 30 other states have passed, making it legal to shoot someone when you feel you might be threatened rather than feel you should flee. And the law, as I said, has come in for a lot of criticism. It needs a defender, and who better than today's NRA? Today's NRA, shooting straight to your heart.
I'll stand my ground. I'll stand.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of Nice Corp. Nice people doing nice things. Well, this week was pretty remarkable in the annals of the story of Nice Corp. Because a similar story broke on two continents, which would suggest... coincidence, conspiracy, or news. The story is that... no longer content with just phone hacking and computer hacking, Nice Corp, through a subsidiary, NDS, headquartered in Israel, which they've just sold off, a security company. That is to say, this was a company that dealt with the security of the smart cards involved in the pay TV business, that News Corp, through NDS, had engaged in aiding and abetting pirated smart cards for their pay TV competitors to drive them out of business, which in the case of the competitor in Britain happened, is out of business. Nice Corp invested in an operation called the House of Ill Compute, run by a known hacker. Now, yes, security services do employ hackers to know what they're doing. But... it features articles in its e-zine, does the House of Ill Compute, about how to hack the rival of Nice Corp's pay TV operation on digital, how to hack their smart cards. Critics are likely to ask how NDS was ignorant of the fact that technical guidance on how to hack the rivals were being openly promoted on the site, or if it was aware of what steps it took to inform its rivals. And a similar revelation in Australia that Nice Corp was involved in supporting the hacking of pay TV competitors down there, a story published by the Australian Financial Review. It says it's working with UK police. Sorry, the Australian Federal Police say they are working with UK police investigating the Nice Corp scandal. The Australian government described the pay TV piracy claims raised in the Financial Review as serious and called for any allegations of criminal activity to be referred to the Australian Federal Police. However, Rupert Murdoch took to Twitter to say that only crazy people would believe these allegations. It was News Corp, of course, that had originally denied all the phone hacking allegations before they had to admit that many of them were true. Nice people doing nice things. And just to add to the confusion, Australian officials said they are not investigating that report that it was Nice Corp was involved in piracy. Nice Corp has denied the allegations, but the federal police now say they're not investigating.
I'd hate to call you a liar, but I don't believe you.
All right, well, there you go. Nice Corp, ladies and gentlemen, nice people doing nice things. Finally, about the spill, scientists say they can definitively finger oil from BP's well as the culprit for the slow death of a once brightly colored coral community in the Gulf of Mexico that's now brown and dull. And tar balls are teeming with bacteria, the leading cause of death from eating bad oysters, more than 100 times than the water they floated in and more 10 times more than the sand they rested on. These are tar balls from the BP spill. Yeah, the Gulf's back in business. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet 7.490 kilohertz shortwave on the mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archived whenever you want it, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. Available for your smartphone through Stitcher.com and available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. Abby, just like getting sick from eating tar balls, if you'd agree to join with me then. Would you already? Thank you very much. Uh-huh. Mmm, tar balls. A tip of the show, chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Hawaii, and Chicago desks. And thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. This broadcast is on Twitter, just like Rupert. You'd have to be crazy not to follow me, at The Harry Shearer. The show comes to you from Century Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. This was a rinky-dink operation.